To sync this podcast to the episode, pause now and hit play right after the previously on.
Hi, welcome to the third Outlander podcast of season 5. And this is episode 503. And I'm Tony Graffia, writer, executive producer. And this episode was written by my colleague,
Luke Skelhaus. Happy to be here.
Luke is a co-executive producer, writer extraordinaire, and this is your first solo episode of this season.
Of this season, yes it is. And I am very excited for this one.
And what are we drinking today? Because we forgot it. Oh, yeah. Yes, we forgot it on the last podcast.
We're drinking Bullet Rye. Because
why Bullet?
I don't know. I'd give away the ending. Actually, hopefully everyone listening to the podcast has already seen the episode. A bullet does play a role in this episode. And so we're drinking delicious bullet rye. And here we're talking about mold. Always fun to see Claire teaching Marsley. As Marsley is becoming Claire's apprentice, we're seeing some of the teaching that's going on. We're seeing how apt of an apprentice Marsley is and how interested she is in this search for penicillin.
Who's that guy painting in the... Now, we made a deliberate decision to show that the big house was still in progress. So instead of just opening and the season and everything's built and beautiful... we show that, you know, most of it's built, but there's still ongoing work throughout the season.
So. Yeah, the settlers are helping them finish off both the outside and the inside.
That's a really cool shot. Look, I really like this. Yeah. How did they do that?
That was real time lapse of real mold affecting a real piece of bread.
Wow.
And changing of day and night, showing a passage of time. Claire is doing this experiment with Marsley's assistance to try to find the mold that will give her penicillin. At one point in time, we had her actually discover it here. But through rewrites, we decided that it would be better for the season, better for the arc of episodes, as well as the arc of the character of Claire, that she doesn't discover it quite yet. It also seemed a little unrealistic that she would discover it quite so quickly.
Wow.
Even though we do show that passage of time, it would be a challenging task for her to find penicillin, which is just a naturally occurring mold. But of course she does know what she's looking for because she comes from the future and she's seen
right
the image of what it looks like under a microscope. She's seen that in a textbook and knows exactly what she's looking for.
Can I just say how much I love the new main title this season? I mean, I love that it changes every season, but the choral with the group singing this time, I mean, it's always beautiful every season, but I think this one's particularly moving, and I look forward to hearing this every week, the new one, and some of the new images, which perhaps give clues as to... some book fans will recognize some of the new images and go, oh, I know what that one,
yeah.
I know what that one's going to be.
This title card will become clear later if it isn't clear now of what we're actually seeing there. I'll point out the line of dialogue that sort of gave us this title card. Crickets. I wonder if the crickets were live on the day or if they've been added in post. Great shot.
That's beautiful.
Last we saw Jamie, he was in Hillsborough. And Lieutenant Knox had suggested that he go back to Fraser's Ridge and gather his militia and return to Hillsborough prepared for war with the Regulators. Another example of how we're showing the progression on the house, that the house is not completely built yet, is that Jamie and Claire are still sleeping on a kind of a fold-up bed in the kitchen of the big house.
Yeah. It's kind of a Murphy bed.
Yeah,
like
it is.
A Murphy bed.
And it's very historical, too. It's a very period-appropriate, fold-up kind of Murphy bed. I'm not sure they called it a Murphy bed back then, but art department did research on that and modeled it after something that really existed. I love the reunions between these two, and we've kept them apart for an episode. That moment when they come back together is always such a lovely moment.
I know. I love those two, and I know something Matt always talks about, because whenever there are discussions about, we can't have them separated for an episode, or we can't have them separated for this much of an episode, he always says what the fans love, you know, they love them together, but the coming together is sweeter when they have been apart, mm-hmm. and they do have, you know, they do have separate tracks, sometimes separate story arcs, but then they always, you know, even when they're apart, there's a couple that's so yeah. intertwined emotionally that you don't, you know, it doesn't feel like separate stories, because they're such a huge part of each other's story, no matter where they physically are. I feel that, but I do enjoy these moments, and to just be able to have a scene like this, which you couldn't really have in a normal network show, a scene where he's just coming home and gazing at his beautiful wife yep. in bed and saying a little prayer and waking yeah. her up. I mean, that's the kind of scene that would get cut in a normal show, because they'd be like, nothing's happening, but something very important is happening, you know, to us who love this couple, you know? Yeah. And so
it's part of the magic of the series.
Absolutely.
That's a bit of dialogue that sort of inspired the title of the episode, Free Will. There's lots of discussion in this episode of the choices that we make and not being bound to the choices of others always, but to make your own choice and to live with it. Beautifully lit. I wasn't there for this one. I wasn't on set for this episode.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you the last one that you and I wrote, you were there for block one. A different writer went to supervise this block. So as a writer, it is a little hard, even though it's your fellow writer, you have to trust your fellow writer to oversee the things you've written, to the lines that are your favorite lines, or when you have something that you've talked about in the room, they know from you know, how all of the writers' discussions in the room, which parts are really important to you, or which parts we that engendered a lot of discussion, and they go and you have to hand over your baby to somebody else and say, make sure that this gets done the way that you hoped it is, to, you know, that mm-hmm. you envisioned it. And sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's you're disappointed, frankly, but more often than that, you're happy to pleased. See, because a lot of times, even if something isn't exactly the way you envisioned, with you know, actors of this caliber and the good directors and the team that we have in Scotland, things come back that sometimes knock you off your feet because it's better than what you envisioned, and that's an amazing. It's not often you work on a show like that, so it's something we value about Outlander.
Yeah. It's very exciting to see the dailies come in and to watch the initial cuts. If you weren't there on the day, to see it for the first time is exciting. What I like about this moment at the end of this scene, you know, there's so many big things going on this season, as in every season. There's war and rumors of war, death, fear of death, the past, the future, all of these things. And yet really what it comes down to is these two characters, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the other characters in the show, the relationships, the love that they have. So that line at the end of that scene where she says, you need my help, and he says, I always have. It's just such a great moment. It brings it back to what's really essential about this show, I think.
Yeah.
I've never seen Scotland like that, with green leaves on the trees. I've only ever been there in winter or late, you know, early spring or late fall. I love how green it is around the big house. Grabbing some.
It's a very, very green. It rains because of all the rain.
And here too, we see unfinished railings and posts and beams on the roof, indicating that the house is still being finished. The idea was that they had worked so hard to get it finished for the wedding and didn't quite get it done in time, and the work is still ongoing. I never know, again, because I wasn't there on the day, but the birds, do we add some of that in post? Is that just live on the day, actual birds? It's probably a little bit of both.
It's probably a little bit of both. I think there's some added, but sometimes if there are birds or sounds on certain takes, what they do can add more to smooth it out, because the problem would be if there were birds on one take, and not on the next take, then you have inconsistent birds.
True.
So you take the birds you're stuck with and you fill in birds on the rest to make it sound like it all flows together. Yeah, that's gorgeous. That's just, I like that they had made such a long road leading up to the big house so that we could always have these entrances and exits. I mean, that was planned. And, oh, here's some of our... Jamie's kind of got a new posse this season, and they're men who are settlers and neighbors. Some he knew from Ardsmuir prison that settled on his land. We've got, see if I can see them and point them out. We see the Bugs for the first time who work at the Ridge. Some of Jamie's new men that'll be riding with him.
Yeah, we'll see them in later scenes in this episode, if not right now. But yeah.
And a lot of new kids.
There's John Quincy Myers back there throwing some bags in a
Marcely's got Germaine, and this is her new daughter.
Yes, Ruth, I think. Ruthie.
Ruth.
I think that's right, isn't it?
Actually, I don't think...
Is that wrong?
I'm not sure if it's Ruth. We are working on season 6 right now, so our brains are full of the new stories. You'll have to forgive us.
Forgive the lapses in memory.
If it's not Ruth, we could name maybe her next kid Ruth.
So there's a lot. This scene does a lot of interesting things. I think it sets up some ongoing story for a lot of characters, for Brianna, who's staying at the Ridge, for Roger, who's going along as a militia captain but doesn't quite feel up to the task. Certainly for Jamie and Claire. Jamie gives Claire a gun at the beginning of this episode for her protection as they march closer to war. They're heading to a town called Brownsville that we haven't been to before. Marcely is left at the Ridge and tasked with continuing to look for penicillin. So there's a lot that this scene does, and hopefully it's more than anything else, just an emotional scene of people parting, perhaps for a long time. Yeah, What a great location that is for us.
Oh, it's gorgeous. And there's a little stream or creek right to the left there.
Sometimes very noisy and rushing and full, and sometimes not much more than a trickle. Another beautiful location.
I know it looks random, like, oh, look, there's just a little spot that they're riding through. It just took like 4 seconds, but we actually go on scouts where we, you know, tromp through the woods for miles and miles.
Yeah.
Sometimes feels like hours, and then until the director or the producers are like, okay, this spot right here, from this tree to this tree, they're going to ride between those two trees, and that's the spot.
And one general location might serve for 4 or 5 different small scenes like that, of a passage of time or a place where they camp for the night. And you always have to be careful what you write in a script. You know, I think I wrote the militia troop travels through trees and over shallow creeks. Well, now I've just made them go find a creek that, you know, is shallow enough for them to cross with horses and carts, and they've got to go do their best to find that, you know. Always nice on this show to bring it back to one of the villains, to bring that worry and concern back into our characters' lives. It's great drama.
Well, actually, Bree does know, but they don't know that she knows, because she overheard Jamie and Lord John talking in episode 501.
Yeah. I like the messiness of all of this, too. It's fun when we are breaking the episodes and writing the episodes to get into the messiness of these characters and their pasts, Jamie's past, with Blackjack Randall, Claire's own interactions with Randall and with Bonnet. It really is complicated, messy stuff that's fun to write.
Yeah. Oh, well, here's our
campfire. Here's the troop of guys, yeah.
Here's the group of guys. We love these guys. It's quite a task when we know we're going to need 4 or 5 guys to ride around with Jamie and be his gang. And you have to cast different types so that people don't go, oh, those, who's who? They look just alike. So we look for different, different guys and who fit the characters from the book. We've got the Lindsay brothers, Evan Lindsay, played by Gary Lamont. We've got his brother Kenny Lindsay, Jack Tarleton, Jordy Chisholm, played by Gilly Gilchrist, and Ronnie Sinclair, played by Paul Donnelly. And these guys, it was just a lot of fun casting them. We watch their auditions, and sometimes someone will, you know, maybe there won't be, you know, we'll have a group that's supposed to be Evan Lindsay, and maybe we cast Gary, but maybe we didn't like, say if we didn't like any of the Ronnie Sinclairs, we can go, oh, hold on, this other guy auditioned for Evan, and let's pull him over to be Ronnie. That didn't happen in this particular case. I'm just saying that sometimes we do mix and match, and
someone who isn't quite right for that role, but they'd be perfect for another. Yeah.
They'll get cast, and we'll be like, oh, actually, we want you for some other role. And these are also, this is someone, well, he's not exactly new. He's a new character, but the same actor.
Right.
He's playing twins.
This is where we reveal in mere moments that this is not Josiah, who we saw in episode 501. This is Keziah. Here's Josiah. They're twins. It's a great reveal that we took right out of the book. In the book, we meet Josiah at the gathering, at the beginning of the Fiery Cross book, and we don't know that he has a twin brother until this moment as they are traveling towards Brownsville and towards Hillsborough.
Now, how do they shoot that? How do they do that? Is that like a Parent Trap kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Where it's like, there's a lot of art to it. There's a lot of technology magic to it. As far as I see, I wasn't there, but as far as I understand, they had to choose their shots very wisely and judiciously to show both of them in the same shot, because that would take a lot of time.
And this is Paul Gorman, by the way.
Paul Gorman playing both roles.
And he's a newer actor, I believe. I believe it's one of his first, if not his first TV.
I think that's right.
Show.
Yeah, we really liked his audition.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he was a student at the Scottish Academy.
The Academy, yep.
Where the same one that Sam attended.
So there's an example where there's technology involved. They're shooting the scene twice. There's wardrobe changes involved, obviously, and the actor himself has to get into a different sort of frame of mind. And so it does take extra time and money to do these shots. But he really brought something interesting and different to both roles, to both characters. And just, this was a fun scene to write. This is one of those tricky scenes where there's actually a lot of information coming out in these scenes. But hopefully, if I've done my job well, it's also an emotional scene and an interesting scene. It's a scene about character. I love this moment, this little story here. I think it's such a sweet moment.
Yeah, that's a nice line. You instantly kind of fall in love with him. And
this is Claire using reflected light to see down into his eardrums, sees that they're ruptured. There's a reminder there where he rubs his throat that he's got bad tonsils, which we revealed in episode 501. A sore throat that's still bothering him. You imagine that moment. You're a woman from the future, and you meet this 14-year-old kid who was indentured for a term of 30 years. He's only halfway through his period of enslavement in his young life. There was some stuff there, some information there that we teed up in episode one when Jamie offers Josiah some land on the ridge, a place to settle if he'll be a hunter for the ridge while he, Jamie, is away. And so now there's a wrench in that plan, which is that Jamie learns that the guy that he gave land to and the guy that he hopes to rely on as a hunter for the ridge while he's gone is actually indentured as a servant to some other people nearby. And he's got to now go and buy that indenture. It's just a nice reveal. You look for these moments where the plans are thwarted, and now the story goes off in a new direction.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a callback. You know, Jamie himself, I believe, stole bread or cheese in you know, in his earlier life, and I think that's part of why he was flogged, or he's had run-ins like that, because there's times where you're starving and you steal something, and it doesn't mean that you're a thief for life. It just meant maybe you were in a desperate situation where it's a life or death situation. And for these kids who are being mistreated and starved, you know, to be branded the rest of your life. I mean, essentially that's what happened to Jamie, and yeah, he's been branded with his own scars. So he relates to these lads. This is a bit of a different episode for Outlander. I think Fiery Cross is full of these kind of a little bit of an eclectic mix of stories, and a complex book in that way, where there's these little mini movies within this book. And I always say, as writers, we pretty much never fight over stories. We almost all spark to different parts of the book. So when we parse out the stories, you know, sometimes they're assigned, but sometimes it's like, hey, I want to write this one or that one. I know that even though I thought this was interesting in the book, it was a bit of a, it leaned towards the horror genre almost, and it wasn't something that I was keen to write, but I know for you,
yeah,
you really loved it.
I sparked to it right away when I read it. It's just a really interesting story. It is almost a standalone episode in some ways in the book as well as in the series. It's very different for us. I loved that it had that sort of cabin in the woods, gothic horror movie feel to it. I very much, when I read this, I wrote in the margins of my book, you know, this is an episode. This is a whole episode, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I really had a lot of fun writing it, had fun sort of coming up with some of these scare moments. Not that the goat is necessarily a scare moment. But
look at the broken windows. It's creepy. It's scary. It's definitely got a different tone
here
than other episodes. And there's, you know, a strange woman inside there. I think it's kind of unique.
It's
and
a very eerie
thing. Yeah, it's eerie. This is Fanny Beardsley, played by Bronwyn James. We looked at a lot of auditions. This was a tricky role because this woman, you know, obviously she's pretty heinous in what she's done. But yet she's got to have a vulnerability about her because, you know, she's been abused.
Yeah.
And she's had a horrible time of it. And as another person that's in a desperate situation and resorts to maybe things that you know wouldn't do, but you know, circumstances have almost, you know, kind of made,
yeah,
her go crazy.
There's a craziness to her, but
that she's trapped with this in this life or out in the woods with the, you know, in these times. You couldn't just go, you couldn't necessarily just be like, hey, I'm just not that into you anymore. You know, you'd marry someone or get, you know, be with someone, be in a situation where there was no out, you know,
yep.
And there wasn't much law where there wasn't anyone you could go report, you know, domestic abuse or anything like today's world, obviously. And, even in today's world, there's people that get trapped in situations. And so this is kind of the 18th century version of that.
Yeah.
But
I think they did a great job with this episode. I love the eeriness of it, the creepiness of it. This moment here, taken from the book. This was originally going to be on the outside door, but we placed it here.
It looks amazing, and they've got, yeah, goats inside the house.
The goats are from the book. There's a lot of stuff we did in this one where we took elements of this sequence of scenes in the book that,
mm-hmm,
that took place here at the cabin, but also later on in some woods and on a bit of a journey, and we condensed it all into this one location, this one creepy cabin in the woods.
This episode was directed by Jamie Payne, who was new to our Outlander family, did an amazing job here, and actually was invited back and does another couple episodes later this season. He was in the Starz family, and Starz really liked his work and pointed him over in our direction. And this was, I think, a difficult episode to be your first episode to direct, because it is just such a different type of episode. A lot of out-of-the-box stuff going on here.
Yeah. There's the billy goat. In the book, the billy goat's name is Hiram, but we named a character in another episode Hiram, so we decided to change it to Billy. We thought
why?
That was funny that she would just name the billy goat Billy. I don't know. I thought that was funny.
Yes,
it's not that funny, but it makes me laugh every time she says, "Oh, that's just Billy."
Yes, Hiram Brown. He's in the next episode. You'll hear about him next week.
Yep.
This is a nice shot.
Yeah.
Ooh.
It's so eerie. What is that? Something dripping.
This is a real episode where you really need to create that mood and that tension.
And the soundtrack is so good, too, you know, for that purpose.
Claire's like, something's not adding up.
What's she gonna find, Tony?
Well, I think it's one of those things where she doesn't want Claire to find him, or she says that, but probably a part of her wants people to know and wants someone to see what she's been through and how all this happened, you know.
These flies were all added in post.
Well, I hope so.
That would have been miserable. That was when I read that in the book. This moment is kind of what made me go, this is something cool for us. This is something cool to do.
When they see that guy, yeah.
And he's not dead.
And this is in such a small space. I mean, there's a real claustrophobia going on here. And just to talk a little bit about production, what usually happens on the morning of the scene, you know, when we're shooting the scenes, is that there's a rehearsal, and everyone has like a shrunken down version of the scenes called sides. So they're a very small piece of paper that's about a fourth the size of a regular piece of paper. Everyone's got those rolled up in their pockets, and the first thing that happens is the director has a quick line read through of the scene so that we can discuss anything that we might need to tweak a word here or there for the actors to say them comfortably. And then they have a private rehearsal with the director and the writer-producer on set, and the actors. And we go through this scene, and it gets blocked. And then once that's worked out, they have what's called, they call in the crew for the crew rehearsal. And then we say, okay, ready. And then the DP comes in, the crew, and there's probably 100 people standing around. And I always think about that when I'm watching the episode and these tiny sets. I remember like, oh, it was cool when it was just us. Oh, and also Margaret, our script supervisor, who has a script and makes sure that everything gets said and makes editing notes for the editors. Mm-hmm. We're the only ones in the private rehearsal. And then when the crew comes in, it really sometimes is a matter of squeezing
40 people in this space.
A ton of people into this tiny space, this little lot. And that's what I'm thinking about in this little scene here in this loft. And everyone watches the scene and sees then they see where the lights need to go, where this, you know, where all the equipment needs to go, where which camera angles are going to go first, and then everyone goes away for about half an hour to an hour while the set is lit, and then they call the actors back, and now we're ready to shoot. But yep. And it's pretty much that way on every single scene.
Every scene. Here we introduce a couple of young guys. This is Roger gathering more soldiers for the militia.
And this is where we meet Hugh and Ian Finley.
And this was a scene. It's a great moment for Roger. This was a scene that was taken from much earlier in the book. It happens at the gathering that that starts the book, where Roger goes out as a militia captain and gathers men for Jamie's militia. We didn't play it in episode 501. We play it here, where on the way to Brownsville, on the way to Hillsborough, they are continuing to gather men for the mm-hmm. militia, and in this case, very young men, boys. And Roger is burdened by this responsibility and this sense of protecting them.
Yeah, this is part of his job as captain, and you know, he's afraid of doesn't want to have to shoot and kill anyone. But that's only part of the, you know, what he has to face being a captain, you know, having to promise a mother to bring back her sons alive is a burden, as you say.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. There's
some more prosthetics of disgusting things.
But those are real maggots, right?
I think they were real maggots on a prosthetic wound, obviously.
Yeah.
The actor playing Aaron Beardsley is Chris Fairbank, and did just a fantastic job, because if you think about it, he doesn't say a word in the entire episode. He acts with essentially almost just one side of his face the whole episode, and is, you know, he's got to communicate all kinds of stuff just through his eyes, really. And yeah. It was really impressive.
Yeah, that was a very tricky role to cast. And we have, you know, we watch casting tapes and watch auditions. And on this one, I remember, I think one of the things we did was actually turn the sound off and kind of just watch the faces of the men, because there was no words in the scene for them to audition with. So we would watch like scenes from other shows they'd done. And we just wanted to see how expressive their faces yeah. were and how much they could convey with just eyes. And at first we thought, God, you know, who's going to even want to play this role when they see that they have to, A, go through hours and hours, because the audience probably doesn't realize that these prosthetics take so long to put on. It sometimes means the actor comes in at 4 a.m. If we're shooting at 7 a.m., instead of everybody coming in at, like, you know, an hour early, the people with prosthetics, including Sam with his back and the scars on his back, have 3 hours of makeup and prosthetics to go through. So they have a much earlier call, and it's very grueling to play a part like that and then lay there all day like that. But so we're like, hey, you know, whoever's brave enough to really want to do this, you know, deserves this part. And then this guy did an amazing job at that. So my hat's off to him for sure.
He's an accomplished actor, and it was great that we were able to get some of his caliber to do a role without any lines, but really an important role. This is, you know, again, so much of this comes from this, you know, series of chapters in the book that is just this little horror movie in the middle of this book. And we don't play every moment exactly as it occurs in the book, but boy, it was fun to adapt this section. Here's an example. This is something where she gives birth. That happens much later in the book. Not much later. It happens a chapter or two later in the book. It happens off screen in the woods. They find the baby, and she has disappeared. Well, we decided to play it this way. Let all of the action happen in this one location.
In the cabin, yeah.
and just play the drama of it. Just play the shock of it.
I think it makes it more claustrophobic and disturbing to see. And also for this guy to have to hear this.
Yeah.
And know there's a baby coming, because what we're about to discover is that it is not his baby. It's a great story of, like, who's really the bad guy here, yeah. Because you have such sympathy for the man at first and think the woman's, you know, crazy and torturing him and wants to kill him. And then, of course, we learn, you know, that the reason that she did all of this.
Yeah, he was abusive and
the bad guy.
Killed three or four of his earlier wives.
Not to mention was abusive to Josiah.
Yep, and Gezi both. His... Yeah. So there he's... It's unclear if he overheard their conversation, but he's about to find out the baby isn't his. Oh, that's creepy.
Yeah.
I remember writing this one. Yeah. I'm not sure if it's that scene or another scene. I described a look between Jamie and Claire where they're just thinking to themselves, what the hell have we gotten ourselves into? And here's a scene where we see her human side. I love it. This was a, as you hinted at, a really demanding role and a hard one to cast. And she just really blew us away, Bronwyn James. She has to play totally, almost psychotic, crazy, messed up, and yet she has to play so human here as well, and so broken and hurt. And lonely. It's just a real range.
I think she's like his fifth wife.
Yeah.
And I know in the book there was a thing where they see the graveyard, like with four crosses or something, yeah. And it's all the other wives that God, you know, God knows he probably killed them. And that the wives appeared to her as ghosts in the book to tell her, to warn her about him.
Yep.
But it was too late. She was already there with him, and that was pretty creepy and spooky in the book. We get these real babies for these scenes, and you know, some of the audiences might know this, but we're very limited on the time we get.
Yeah.
You know, you can't have a baby on set for hours or under these hot lights. So there's very, very strict rules in the UK and in the US about how long you can use a baby for. So, and usually it's something like maybe only 15 minutes total. So you have to grab all the shots with where the baby is prominently viewed, and then your time's up, and then the other shots might be just a doll, a very lifelike doll that's wrapped in the blanket, or will turn the baby away from camera and mix that with the shots of the baby, the real baby. But that, obviously, that's the real baby there. And sometimes the babies cooperate, sometimes not. Sometimes they cry and shriek during the whole, and your whole 15 minutes is a crying baby. But, you know, that's real life. So sometimes you just use the crying baby if you have to. Sometimes you get lucky and you get, you know, whatever the mood of the scene that you want is. But no babies were harmed in the making of. Also, I always wonder, I mean, just to talk about the prosthetics on Mr. Beardsley again, when their eyes are really red like that, and it looks like their eyes are, what they use there is contacts, yeah. And they have them specially made. You can't just get any old contacts. There's a specialty place in London, I believe, and they order contacts, and they have them specially fitted to the actor, and they wear those so that their own eyes aren't hurt. Yeah. But
the actors have to go see an optometrist.
And we have one on the set as well. There, I believe, has to be an optometrist on the set, you know, so that if they need to take them out or if there's any problems with them, it's just something they supervise. I don't know if that's a rule, but I know I've seen been there when there was an optometrist on the set who was sort of keeping an eye out for the safety of the actors.
This cabin, the interior and the exterior, is actually Roger and Brianna's cabin, repurposed and redecorated to some degree, rebuilt. Little parts of it on the outside were built out, and certainly the shingles were changed on the outside. But we were able to reuse that structure to give us this cabin in the woods that is, you know, meant to be strikingly different. And I think the art department, as always, did a marvelous job. I don't know with this prosthetic if it was the whole body. I think at times it's the whole body. Is that prosthetic fake body lying there? I really liked that moment. Yeah. That was nice. An important moment for me to get to, this moment where she confesses that.
Yeah. It says,
they used that in the promo for this season, I noticed.
It's definitely a catalyst for Claire to be thinking, I don't want my own kids and grandkids in this world, because it's very dangerous. And when Jamie says not the only world, it's really not for them. It's not. Yeah. There are two different worlds. But you know, I mean, I guess I'm always the one in the writer's room when we're talking about the stories and how it's important to send them back because it's safer. Yes, there's better medicine and maybe you won't get eaten by a mountain lion. But I mean, you know, this world we live in, it has its own dangers. Yeah. I mean, these guys aren't going to have nuclear war. You know, there's these guys, there's to me a lot of things safer about living in this time. There's not the I guess living a more natural life in some ways and not worrying about some of the things that make us sick or that are dangers in our society. They don't have those things. So it's arguable whether it's safer. Truly safer in our time than this time. But maybe I just want to go back and live there.
I always wonder, we always have a fire going in the background, a scene like this. I guess you have to believe Jamie woke up in the middle of the night and stoked it, threw a few more logs on.
Mm-hmm. I think Brianna just needs to invent those logs that burn, like the ones you get.
So again, this was a moment that occurred a bit later in the book, out in the woods, camping in the woods. Mrs. Beardsley disappears and they find the baby. I've said it already. I'm repeating myself. But for me, that was the challenge and the fun of this episode, was to take these sort of this stretched out sequence of events in the book and really coalesce it and encapsulate it in this one shorter time frame, in this one location. It was a fun challenge. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, something else that we do that's very accurate and very painstaking is that when you see documents like this, they have been researched. We find real examples of the 18th century documents, whether they're letters, personal letters, legal papers, whatever they are, and the art department recreates them. Often they'll ask the writers or the researcher, mm-hmm. or Danny Barrow, who... advises us on a lot of historical elements and has done also a lot of that sort of thing where, you know, especially in Scotland with the production, it'll be like, we need some wording to go on here. We can make the document, but we don't know, you know, how to phrase it or what it should say. We get someone who's very knowledgeable about historical language to... Because I couldn't personally write that. I wouldn't know the legal terms of the words they used back then. And we'll have someone mock up the words, and then they will do a version of it, and then we take a look at it, and we go, yeah, that looks good. Or, but everything's very, very true to to the times.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people, a lot of departments working together to make all of this super authentic. Whether you're talking about the costumes, the props, you know, that mantelpiece back there, you know, the candle on the mantle, it's all very...
Oh, it's amazing the lengths that are gone to. It's sort of a crime. All the things you don't see that have gone into it. Sometimes when I know that we've gone to great lengths to make something look really authentic and it doesn't make the final cut... You know, it's not a reason to keep the scene, but sometimes a scene has to be cut, unfortunately. And then I'm like, not only was this a good scene, and I hate to lose it, but oh my God, we took forever to make this thing. And the art department, you know, went to great lengths to make it. And it doesn't make it on camera. But luckily, there's so much that is on camera that you get to see when you realize that none of it existed. It all has to be brought in. Everything you see was made or chosen or put there by someone. It's an enormous amount of work. And after this many years on the show, it's amazing the passion that still exists of people on the crew that just give 110%, even though they've been working on this show for so long. They're still excited about it and give their all. Is this where Jamie asks him?
Yeah. He's making him blink once for yes, twice for no. He's offering him a choice. Well, he's about to anyway. Offer him a choice, not only to die, but to confess his sins.
He's a religious guy. Yeah. And... even a heinous man like this, Jamie's like...
Well, he says, I have no desire to send a man to hell, you know?
Yeah.
This is a man worth saving. Every man, woman, and child deserves a chance at the end of their life to get right, you know?
Yeah. But this guy does not want it.
He refuses it. And that's, again, the title, Free Will. This man has a choice, and he makes it.
Well, I love that Jamie's both compassionate enough to offer him this choice to save his soul, and yet Jamie's strong enough to do what needs to be done. Yeah. And
I love that the blink And he blinks so slowly, you don't know if he's blinking yes or no, because you think it could just be one blink. But then he blinks again, and you realize he's refused the offer.
That's... Oh, I love that this was played off camera. Mm-hmm.
I remember lots of conversations in the room, too, about what Jamie does there. Is it, you know, did the guy deserve, is that a mercy that Jamie gives him? Did the man deserve that kind of mercy?
Right.
You know, we had interesting debates about that. And here again, we bring it back to the personal and what it is for these two characters.
Yeah, we bring it around to what Jamie, you know, was thinking about his own father.
Mm-hmm.
This was added, right? Because I think at one point it ended with the gunshot.
It did.
Cut to black.
Yep.
And you decided...
Yeah, it was. We decided that this, it really was the right call to bring it back to this elemental sort of personal thing for Jamie. What happened to his dad and wondering if his dad suffered like this man suffered.
And worried that it could happen to him.
Yeah.
And if it does, would someone else have the strength to put him, you know, at peace, if need be, from the suffering? And he knows that Claire has that kind of strength. And that's another strength of their relationship, that they both would do for each other whatever needed doing in the end.
Yeah, it's a powerful scene at the end. I'm glad we were able to get that in there. I'm really happy with that episode. I hope all of the viewers liked it, and I hope certainly fun for us to talk about it.
Awesome. Well, we'll be here again next week.
All right. Thank you, guys.
For episode 4.